Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levypayers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hi everybody, welcome to the AHDB Food and Farming Podcast. I'm Amy Hughes, I'm one of the Senior Engagement Managers in the Beef and Lamb team. So this podcast is about marrying ecosystem function and food production, so how do we get that balance right? As part of the Roots to Resilience programme at AHDB, we did some events in January with Professor Jason Rowntree from Michigan State University on this very same topic. And the three farmers that are joining me today took part in a panel session at one of these events. So I really just want to go into more detail with these guys on what ecosystem functioning means for them and why it's important and what practices they incorporate to improve ecosystem functioning while still producing food and obviously running a profitable business. So I'm going to give you a quick introduction to the farmers that are joining me. We have got some amazing videos that we did with these guys that showcase a little bit more of how they're farming and why they're farming the way they are. And we'll put the links to those in the show notes. So I would encourage you to go and watch those because they're really good videos. But first of all, we've got Ian Horsley. So Ian and his wife, Rosanna, are first generation farmers who started on a small traditional farm in Devon in 2014 and then expanded the business and moved up to Worcestershire in 2017. So change has been constant through Ian's farming career, developing a performance recorded, the Welsh are going to pull me up on this, clean flock, and then to... my husband, 2 years ago, making the decision that cattle would be better suited to their regenerative farming approach. So Bayston Hall is now 90% Aberdeen Angus cattle and 10% sheep, with a key focus on soil health, biodiversity and pasture-fed meat. So Ian's doing things like using adaptive multi-paddock mob grazing. The cattle support a calf over winter on hay and pasture alone and calve unaided each year. The farm is also in a mid-tier countryside stewardship, including hedge laying, GS4 legume and herb-rich swards and a GS2 low-input grassland. So thanks for joining us, Ian. Next, we've got Silas Headley-Lawrence. So Silas is FAI Farms farm manager. He oversees the commercial farming enterprise and coordinates the farm with its research obligations. So I'm sure Silas will tell us a little bit more about the research projects that are going on there as well as the commercial farm. Silas has got 8 years experience managing farms regeneratively with an emphasis on organic year-round grazing systems. And he's got ties to New Zealand through his family dairy farm and kiwi fruit orchards. And he maintains an emphasis on lean, profitable farming systems that also deliver on increasing biodiversity and soil health gains. And last, but by no means least, we have Emily Padfield. So Emily farms beef and sheep alongside her husband in Warwickshire, and she's also a freelance journalist. The Lowland Heavy Clay Farm has transitioned from an 800 ewe indoor lambing intensive sheep enterprise to one that now includes suckler cattle, a small lower input outdoor lambing flock, property lets and a new equestrian partnership, as well as a mid-tier countryside stewardship scheme, which utilises grant opportunities wherever possible. Emily is also a 2022 Nuffield Scholar, and she's just presented her scholarship, The Mob Grazed Flood, Improving Soil Biodiversity and Farm Income. So hi, everybody. Thanks so much for giving me your time today and joining me on the podcast. Are you all well?
Very well.
Doing good.
Very yeah. Your intro is.
Very impressed with my intro as well. You know, I do try. So you guys, again, very kindly gave us your time back in January. We did some events with Jason Rowntree, as I mentioned in my intro, and you guys sat on a panel session just to talk about what you were doing at home and how you were trying to farm with the ecology in mind, but also run a profitable food production business, profitable farm. I really just want to expand on sort of what you said on the panel session back in January and just dig into the nitty gritty really of why you are farming in the way that you farm, why that's important to you. So I suppose that's my first question, like, why is it important to you as a business and in your business model and for yourselves personally, maybe, to use agroecological practices in your business? Who shall I go to first? Let's go to Ian first.
So my wife and I, basically, we came to farming from an interest in food. My wife's a dietitian by training, and I was interested in food and provenance and just growing my own, basically. That's how we kind of came to it later on as a second career. The key driver for us is to have the most nutritious, best raised animals and livestock we can have so that we can feed ourselves, and any surplus, obviously, we can feed to friends, family, customers, the wider community and network. So our desires are to make the best quality food. And from our point of view, the best quality food comes from a grass-fed system. and to have a fully functioning grass-fed system that is also profitable, you need to have really fully functioning biological soils. So those can do all the heavy lifting for you. So we're not relying on external inputs, fertilizers, external feeds. We want the soil to be doing everything it can do. So working with sort of agroecological practices to get the soil functioning as well as we can. Obviously, this is a journey. We're definitely trying to slowly improve our soils to get to a point where they will provide the minerals and the nutrients that the required in the grass to get the best performance out of the grass and forage production that will make the cattle and the sheep grow the best, taste the best, and reflect our local specific terroir, use the French term, to flavour our meat and provide the best quality, high omega-3, omega-6 ratio meat for people to eat. So using, I think it's very important if we use external inputs, you can change the system and maybe accelerate returns, but you're having to take external inputs and those then counterbalance what the soil will do naturally for you. So we have to work to a system and get our soil to do everything for us, do all the heavy lifting, provide everything that we need. And that has all the wider benefits in the for the wider biodiversity element, from insects all the way up through to the birds and prey species that are mammals, invertebrates that live in our farm.
Silas, why are you farming in the way that you are?
I started farming in New Zealand, kind of on our family dairy farms, Kupert Orchards. So I never really understood how to produce milk or meat off of grass-based systems with no housing, that were really low input, really low cost per head, and just maximizing production off of not very much and being quite strict with getting the animal to fit in the system, etc. So I'd never seen a cattle shed or put an animal in a shed until I started farming in the UK a bit more in my early 20s. So I guess when I started managing farms in the UK in my early 20s, I just reverted back to what I knew, which was just get animals in fewer groups of large mobs and move them around the farm, grow as much grass as possible, and just try to stop spending money and maybe we'll make a bit more money. It worked well. And those early farms I managed, they certainly changed and evolved and seemed to perform better with that kind of approach. And I guess it's naturally then I found my way into regen ag and the space of organics. I guess I was doing that out of intuition and playing with stuff, but then I kind of dived down that rabbit hole and understood what I was doing a bit more. For me, I kind of had that big light bulb moment. I was completely sold on the system, the benefits to soil health, your farm's resilience, productivity, the performance of your animals, reducing costs, vet and meds, all the things that kind of regenerative low input systems can deliver, as well as obviously the biodiversity and ecosystem benefits. So when I came across the farm manager role at FAI Farms in Oxford, it was an easy move for me, because for FAI, they'd been a tenant on this farm in Oxford for about 20 years. It's about 400 hectares or so of floodplain pastures with a little bit of arable. They always had loads of beef and sheep, chickens. So the system and what was done on the farm always evolved quite quickly, and the enterprise on the farm often changed to align with the research objectives. But 4 years ago, they found their way to regen and figured that on this farm, actually, you should be able to grow a lot of grass and produce a lot of red meat from very low input systems. So despite being kind of medium heavy clay on the floodplain, things like outwintering were, it was said, that will never work here on this farm. But they launched what is called the AMP project, Adaptive Multi-Paddock Grazing Project, which was basically a four-year deep dive into what the transition on this farm in Oxford, what happened on this farm over that four-year period as they moved away from quite conventional management within their organic system. So lots of set stocking, housing the cattle and sheep in sheds all winter, finishing the cattle on barley, creep feeding the calves, creep feeding the ewes, quite a lot of inputs basically still within that organic context. What happened on this farm as that system changed to be basically a fully kind of regenerative, pretty much closed system, outwintering cattle? There was a spread of about 65 different metrics at the start of the project, you know, covering soil health, cattle and livestock production metrics, as well as the biodiversity and some social factors too. So we're at the end of that 4-year project now, so we're just kind of collating a lot of the data, but we've had some really interesting insights so far.
So Emily, talk us through then what agroecological practices you're using and why, I suppose, you know, why have you decided to go down that route?
So basically, having been involved in the industry from graduation, I've kind of seen a lot of iterations of different farming systems, confinement agriculture, CAFOs, as they quite regularly refer to them in the States. I can see the benefits and drawbacks of every system, and I've visited a lot of farms, both external, you know, externally managed and sort of quite extensive and intensive. And on our farm, which I got involved in about 15 years ago, we haven't been particularly intensive, but at the same time, we have had an intensive indoor lambing flock. And what I was concerned about was the increasing reliance on antibiotics and inputs at lambing time, and also the use of wormers, the use of ivermectins, and also the fact that it was actually the whole thing was quite costly. The inputs were getting quite a lot, and they seemed to be getting more every year as we were throwing more drugs to try and overcome not particularly ill health, but just an intensively grazed system, intensively lambing inside. And despite trying to use every tool in our arsenal for things like joint ill, we were, every year was a bit of an unknown as to what we were going to sort of experience in that year. On the back of that, I kind of started doing some research, and I read Nicole Masters' For the Love of Soil, and that sort of made me think. And then having MS myself, it also made me think of the environmental factors that affect our health, how our nutrient availability in our food really has gone so downhill. Like Ian was saying, his priority is creating and supplying nutrient dense food, and I think it's our responsibility as farmers to do the best we can on that front whilst sort of working within the environment that we have. So that's kind of what started us down this route in a kind of roundabout sort of way. And then we did some pretty in-depth soil analysis and realized there was a lot of lockup in our soils, and what were the reasons behind that. I think because we're pretty much all permanent pasture, it was the way we were grazing that was perhaps affecting our pastures and the availability of forage and the quality of forage and the nutrient uptake of those plants, and therefore the nutrient uptake of our animals. And instead of having to buy the minerals and supplements and inputs, I just thought that we've got plenty in our soils. We've got heavy clay soils, which are very, very high quality, but they need careful management to be able to release those minerals. I think the industry has spent billions on sort of perfecting and honing livestock farming to try and exert complete control over the system to get growth rates and to get, you know, the actual costs and everything to within an inch of their lives. But in a bid to do this and to drive down costs and provide retailers a uniform product that will fit in a specific packet, farmers have kind of sleepwalked it down this route because we've been responding to that demand from retailers.
Market forces, yeah.
And that's by no means a criticism of farmers, because I think we've all done it, and we've all wanted to seek, you know, efficiencies.
Thank you. So the two things then that I've heard all three of you say here is the nutrient density of the food that you're producing and being on a grass-based system. But the other thing is this thing about reducing inputs and the fact that inputs are costly, and for a profitable red meat production business, we all know that inputs need to be as low as possible. So we'll come back to that in a second when we talk about productivity. But I just want to clear up this sort of almost definition of ecosystem functioning, because I think there's some confusion as to what that actually means. We're not necessarily talking just about biodiversity, are we? We're talking about the way the ecosystem is functioning in your farming business. So Since you have made these changes and started farming in this way, what physical benefits have you seen on your farm in terms of ecosystem function, like how wet it's been this winter? Have you seen any benefits in that respect or in other areas? What are your thoughts on that?
We're definitely seeing benefits. We have sort of very high magnesium type sort of clay soils on one side of the farm. And what I'm trying to use these approaches to do is to improve the soil quality and the soil aggregate so that they breathe better, that water infiltrates better, the roots can get deeper. And through careful management of grass through the growing season, we are starting to improve that. And as we enable our soils to hold more water or more quickly absorb water, obviously we get to a saturation point. Everyone does. We've had a lot of rain. These big events, there's only so much, even with the best will in the world, you can hold. But I'm definitely starting to see improvements there, to the point that fields that I bale grazed 2 years ago are massively improved in terms of their holding capacity for stock, bale grazing them a second time around 2 years later. That's definitely had some improvements, and the long rest periods in between to allow roots to do what they need to do. Now they've got a little bit of a nutrient kick. In terms of other biodiversity benefits, I see a lot more voles, I see more worms, I see more insects, there are more birds on the farm. There was just generally those sort of, we haven't done baseline checks and surveys, but mm-hmm. we've been here 6 years now, and I think there's an improvement, there's been a change. We did do soil sampling, so we're seeing increase in carbon over the period. I think we're only really at the start of the journey. It's a long, slow process.
Emily, what about you?
I think it's definitely a process. This will be our third year going into rotational or mob grazing, rotationally mob grazing. But alongside what Silas said, AMP planned grazing, we're definitely seeing increased aggregation and water holding capacity. Again, we're pretty much about 220% of February's rain. There's only so much you can do to mitigate that. So on that basis, we do house our cattle. But over the last 3 years, we've reduced that. This year, we just housed just before Christmas. And given the wet summer and the wet autumn, we're pretty happy with that. I'm hoping to be able to outwinter some cattle next year. Our sheep are obviously all outwintered. And we're outdoor lambing. We're due to start on the 15th of March. I think it's important to include in ecosystem management ourselves. So the human aspect of ecosystem management and trying to design the system to take into account our input into that. So grazing management is only as good as the person that's sort of putting it in place, and it's mm-hmm. and it's also your quality of life metrics that determine how effective you're going to be. I think with the tools that we have now, with electric fencing and solar fencing and pasture pumps and all of these great things that are much more readily available now, I think it's so much more straightforward to achieve high intensity grazing quickly and easily, and at the end of the day, the more easy it is to implement, the more likely it's going to be to actually keep going. It was quite entertaining the other day. Our cows got out, so now it's a kind of joke that we've achieved a disturbance event. Well, it's quite a disturbance event, to be honest. It looks like the Grand National has been run over one of our fields, but whereas our neighbouring farmers and perhaps us before would have looked at that and thought, how am I ever going to get that back? I think we're less scared of how that's going to recover, because I think mm-hmm. we're using our animals as a tool to change our grazing platform, if you like. So we're using them much more for their own benefit as well as ours. So it will take time to actually get all those things in balance, for sure. I think by enhancing the soil health, plant health is improved, and by enhancing the plant health, animal health also improves. So it's a process. I think by being biologically sustainable through our soils and our forage, it also goes hand in hand with economic profitability as well.
Yeah.
So
yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Stylus, talk us through your ecosystem functioning and what benefits you've seen.
Yeah, from my perspective, obviously taking context from everything else into account, it's so viewing your farm as an ecosystem or farming regeneracy, you break it down into essentially how do ecosystems work. And that is by through ecosystem processes, which is your carbon cycle, water cycle, mineral cycle, and airflow. And when those four things get better, you will see an improvement in biodiversity below ground and above ground, and hopefully see a more resilient system. So everything I think about, or what we think about as a team, is how do we maximize and facilitate those ecosystem processes throughout the whole year? How do we maximize our carbon cycle through photosynthesis or trampling, you know, essentially stockpiled carbon in the winter when things aren't photosynthesizing? How through our management, our grazing management, can we improve our water cycle by increasing our infiltration rates? As more carbon and water go through your soils and your system and your soil structure improves, and you should also see an improvement in your mineral cycle, as well as obviously animals being outside on your pasture for as much of the year as possible, if not all of it. And again, airflow, as your soil structure improves, you're going to get more air into your soils. It's creating space for that water to go. It's, you know, that's, that air is going to interact with your, you know, your rhizobacteria and stuff to help with other things like your nitrogen cycle and things like that. So how do we do that? For us on a grazing farm, it's grazing management. How much grass can we grow? How can we maximize that solar panel? How can we get our root systems down as deep and as kind of complex as possible, interacting with the mycorrhizal fungi and everything else that can help transfer nutrients and minerals around the soil? And essentially, we've seen a lot of that. Our soil structure has improved a lot over the last 4 years. Our infiltration rates have improved, and you can see that so obviously when we go into these really wet winters and when we go into that massive drought we had in 2022, mm-hmm. because despite these, you know, quite extreme events, which are actually quite normal now, they're not unusual, they're just still extreme. There's a lot of heat and periods, extended periods of dry, or non-stop periods of heavy rain and wet, which is what we're in now, basically. And our cattle production metrics haven't fluctuated throughout those events, i.e. our fertility, our finishing times, day live weight gains, all that kind of stuff has been pretty much level pegging consistent, even through the 3 month drought or the non-stop winter. And that just kind of shows really that we've nurtured that resilience by feeding our soil microbiology. And that in turn has given us, you know, a safety net, if you like, to keep our farm working and functional. Those ecosystem processes are still working even in extreme circumstances, and every year in theory it should improve and get better and better. And, you know, we see that obviously, I guess more anecdotally, but in an obvious way, like every year we notice the biodiversity in our pasture changes, it evolves, the successional state increases and changes, and therefore we're facilitating insects and birds and other things better and better each year, and then it all kind of snowballs upwards. So yeah, ecosystem functioning is that it's looking what happens in nature and how do we harness and facilitate those ecosystem processes through our grazing management. Mm-hmm. And that's it really. And what we've seen is thinking about how we manage the farm, the system we put in place around carbon, water, minerals, airflow, etc., our livestock and the farm performance benefits from that as well. As well as our resilience to those weather events like the drought.
When Jason was over here, I can't remember whether he said it in the event that you were at, or whether he said it to me in the car. He was talking about net zero, dare I say it, and I don't want to dwell on that, but he was talking about net zero, and he said quite bluntly, we will never reach net zero if we continue to use nitrogen because of the whole Haber-Bosch process, like it's our biggest source of fossil fuel usage in the industry. It sounds to me as if you guys have all cut it out. Emily, are you still using nitrogen at all? Have you?
Last year we did apply some fertilizer to a new lay, but this year we don't plan to use any. I just think that the damage it does, it would put us back to square one, really. But it's a constant conversation with my husband, and this way of farming does sort of create a lot of discussion about the yeah, about older systems of farming and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's always a sensitive subject.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I'm absolutely not. The purpose of this conversation is not to say do not use nitrogen. I'm not brave enough to stick my head above the parapet and have it blown off for that one. But I just wanted to talk about nitrogen in terms of the impact that it does have on your soil functioning, and also linking it into production, because I think there's a real fear from a lot of farmers, understandably, that if they stop using nitrogen on the soils that they've currently got, their production is just going to drop like a stone. So in terms of transitioning away from nitrogen usage, how did you find that? How did your production sort of go in line with that? Did you see a drop in the early stages, or how did it work for you all, Silas?
Well, this farm's organic, and I guess I've you know, apart from the days in New Zealand when nitrogen was a big thing, mm-hmm. you know, nitrogen, obviously the way it works in a plant is to create growth, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that there's an effective mineral cycle with the other things in the plant, mm-hmm. the other minerals in the plant needs to be healthy, as well as the animals. So if, again, nitrogen lends itself amazingly well to things like ryegrass. So if you have more diversity in your sward already, or sat there in your latent seed bank, or you're going to start putting in diverse lays, you've got things in there that aren't so dependent on a higher nitrogen fix, or don't respond so much to it. So I think how to transition away from it really depends on your starting point. Mm-hmm. And again, these nitrogen cycles, you can get everything you need from the soil just by thinking about how the nitrogen cycle works. How do you address soil structure to improve the physical condition of your soil, as well as, you know, the carbon, the water and everything else? And the more soil microbiology you have, i.e., you know, if your soils are dried out and you've got little short stunted roots, then you're not going to have things like the protozoa flinging around your soil that eat all the bacteria that pop the nitrogen out the back end in a form that the plants can absorb. So the more you can stimulate soil microbiology, the aim of the game, from my point of view, is you want as much of everything as possible, not just loads of one or two things that are yep. deemed good. And that's true above ground in terms of your plant species, as well as below ground with the types of soil microbiology you want to stimulate. So plants and soils and swards and nature ecosystems have a perfectly functional nitrogen cycle when those things are all in balance. So it will probably be a case for lots of transitions. How do I start to address things like soil structure and either put in more diversity of plant species through a bag of seed or through my management, i.e. using animal impact grazing in time recovery periods to allow more things to come through and avoid overgrazing? How through that can I stimulate soil microbiology and make my natural nitrogen cycle more functional? Obviously, with more air going into your soils and everything else, there's nitrogen going in that. So when that interacts with certain rhizobacteria, you can fixate nitrogen straight out of the airflow, not even needing what's in, you know, going in artificially. So for me, that's the point. It's if you wanted to walk away, you can, but it's thinking, right, what do I need to do to tweak my management and biodiversity yep. to help the nitrogen cycle be more efficient?
Yeah.
Without the need of artificial inputs or less of them. So it's a weaning yep. process, basically.
Okay, Emily, how have you transitioned sort of away from artificial inputs, and have you seen a drop in production? How's that gone for you?
I definitely haven't seen a drop in production in terms of our permanent pasture. Like Silas alluded to, the more diverse your pasture is and how effective your nitrogen cycle is and how you can concentrate on improving that is the key to everything. It's been interesting because we have a lot of white clover in our pastures, but actually noticing when that's fixing nitrogen and when it's not fixing nitrogen, and actually trying to identify what the issues are behind why that nitrogen cycle isn't functioning as efficiently as it could be. We've actually employed the use of, well, we've purchased a sward lifter that we've attached a kind of rip and drip system to feed the biology, to try and kickstart that process, because I guess we're all very impatient as farmers and we want to see results quickly. And sometimes when you're using maybe, you know, trampling or you know, the animals as tools, it is a slower process. And But equally, I'm not convinced that you can fast forward it. But also, it's a kind of balance between we produce all our own sort of saved forage on the farm as well, and our own and straw, etc. It's trying to get a balance of where, you know, how we achieve getting the hay crop, the silage crop, all of those things, whilst still maintaining our grazing platform for our livestock. I mean, like Silas said, it all becomes possible over time, and the function of the soil, so the protozoa and all the bacteria and fungi, the levels. I'm acutely aware that we're bacterially dominant, and so we're trying to address that with compost. Again, trying to manage our compost. We have an equine business and obviously the cattle are in the shed during the winter.
How are you aware of that, Emily? Sorry, have you done some testing? How do you know that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we have done some testing.
Yep.
And also just the indicator species that we have. White clover is quite an indicator of nitrate, sort of heavy soils, and also bacterially dominant. And we've got the layer of compaction and the magnesium, like Ian was saying, the tight magnesium. We're actively trying to kind of bring more fungal dominance in to get the balance right. But I think that there was a quote that someone said, it sometimes can feel overwhelming when you're looking at every single element of the ecosystem on your farm and trying to address every single thing at once. But if you actually step back and say, right, what am I wanting to achieve? I'm gonna just go down this route and try and use the animals as the tools. But also, implementing these strategies with different species isn't always easy. We've got you know, a large percentage of our business is sheep. You know, we aim to finish our lambs. Well, we start to sell lambs. We're mid-March lambing. We start to sell lambs sort of July onwards. We hope to finish them all by the end of the summer. We've had teething problems with longer grass grazing with finishing lambs. That's and that will have some kind of I think it's very contentious, that issue. So I think it's managing a grazing platform for finishing the lambs, as well as managing it for different classes of livestock. And that's where the herbal layers are brilliant, because they provide a huge diversity that we can actually implement in from a bag rather than wait for the process of waiting for the latent seed bag, which I have latent seed bank in the soil, which I have huge faith in, because it's what's suited to our soil rather than buying in seed. But it's a fine balance between paying the bills and achieving that.
Okay, so Ian, what's your experience with nitrogen? Have you ever used it, and if you have, how did you sort of transition off it? What did you see happen?
Only very little amounts, really. When we first came to this farm, we did some field surveys, soil surveys, and came up with a sort of a program. There were a couple of fields that needed a bit of, that were, in my old mentality, were low in phosphate. So there's some DAP, and where I applied a very small amount of a few different fertilizers. I'd muriate of potash as well, which I never used. And actually, in the end of it, I had a couple of bags of things that I didn't use. I bought a small amount. I ended up 2 years later having not used most of it, sold it back to the dealer, because I didn't actually, by the time I got around to using it, my mindset had changed so much. I didn't want to touch
the price. The gone right
it.
Up then as well. Did you make yeah, a killing
he,
on
that's
it?
What, that's, no, he was happy to take it back at the price that I bought it for, even though it doubled in price. Funnily enough, there wasn't any money to be made on it, but it was literally one bag. So I used a little bit, much like I used a little bit of lime and a few other things, but I didn't use much. And so there hasn't really been any transition away from that. We don't have a great deal of compost because we haven't had cattle in the shed much. We haven't had sheep in the shed much. So there hasn't really been that much to use. I've started creating, building Johnson Sue bioreactors and things like that to try and add fungal extracts effectively to the fields to try and boost fungal diversity and populations. because as with most of our grassland soils, they're quite bacterially high. I haven't had it tested. It's something I do want to go down that route and do some tests and see how the soils really are. But I think there's only benefit from adding sort of more fungus to the system if possible.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to do that also, rather than using external inputs, doing it from homemade systems, homemade teas or extracts, and also adding more brown matter to the system by trampling tall, because basically bacteria feeds on the green matter. So if you trample very lush green grass, bacteria dominate and they break that down. If you're trampling tall, leggy, lignified brown grass, that's what fungi feed on. So by feeding the different products to the soil, you can actually sort of hopefully help stimulate the thing you're actually looking for. So I'm looking for more fungi, so I'll try and trample more long, tall, brown, hayy grass into the soil. Mm-hmm. And try and get things going that way. People switching out of nitrogen use, as Silas has said, it's a stage process. You can go cold turkey, but you'll probably suffer until your soils are biologically functioning and you've got a bit of headway into the system and start developing these, getting your soil working. I think it could be, if you've got a ryegrass dominant sward, it's going to be quite a drop in production, which is why I've always, in anything that I've done, whether it's been putting in herbal lays or I've put in one new lay, the lays I've put in, I almost wish I hadn't bothered now. I wish I'd just stayed with improving the old meadows that I had. But we came with a different mindset at the time and we're working to move on from that now. But luckily the when I put those swards in, I put them in with Timothy, Coxfoot, fescues, meadow foxtail, things like that, more that are either deeper rooting, they're more drought tolerant, they're less dependent on nitrogen. I don't want my system to be dependent on nitrogen in the slightest. And that's been a bit of a problem that the farming system has got itself boxed into a corner. We get very, very it does get pushed to a certain extent by the ag colleges and the general farming system that we should put in things that are on the recommended lists, that are all tested by the seed suppliers. And all of these grasses that are recommended, they are recommended on the basis of their ability to function in a high fertility system based on nitrogen. We need to get away from that. We need to move the testing to incorporate other species and other grasses and under systems that aren't nitrogen. Putting 250 kgs of nitrogen on a system, you get a great response from ryegrass. That's why ryegrass has been so dominant in our farming system for the last 60, 70, 80 years, because it responds well to fertilizer. So it ticks two boxes. It does great for seed manufacturing. It does great for fert suppliers. So if we want to get to a low input system, we need to have grasses that respond to this. Nature doesn't have external fertilizers. In an area where if we weren't touching it, in wilded areas, in areas on your hedge bottoms, they rely on a natural cycling of the fertility in that grass, harvesting sunlight, turning it into sugars, turning it in with all the microbes in the soil, getting the nutrients required, and then feeding it back into the system. And this is kind of what I want to replicate across our farm, have it all more like a hedge bottom.
Yeah.
Deep, functioning soils that do all the hard work themselves. I think that will provide the resilience that we want. The hedgerows never seem to dry up in a hot summer's day. You know, I know they're not being grazed. I know they're not getting that, and actually sometimes that might be beneficial. But what we need to do is not just work with our animals to create the system we want, but work with rest and nature. Because I think the most important thing that is often missed out of our farming systems is giving our ground opportunity to rest, whether that be 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 9 weeks, 90 days, 100 days. Can you give a field a whole year's rest? What would that have as an impact going forward for the next 3-4 years in terms of its productivity? It might feel like you've lost productivity in that 1 year, but what does it do 2 years hence to your ability to carry stock through winter?
Okay, thanks, Ian. Right, just for the last 5 minutes then, I just want to really nail down this production thing. I know we've spoken about grass production, but I want to talk about animal performance. And is farming with nature and the ecology in mind only for those people that are direct selling and achieving a premium price for their product? Because that is also a myth that I come across. Now, I know we've got a mix of direct sales and into commercial supply chains here. So can you just tell me some sort of KPIs, key performance indicators, so things like age at slaughter, who you supply, if you're comfortable with telling me that, any, like how many you finish in a year, that kind of thing, and then we can just get a real handle on the fact that you are all producing, you're all still producing food whilst doing all this is the point I'm trying to make. So Silas, go on, tell us about yours.
Yeah, well, we're organic certified, so we do get an organic premium, but we had the organic premium before we transitioned to this system when we were still kind of set stocking and feeding on barley. So nothing's changed there, aside from the fact our cost of production is way less. So just for an example, in the outwintering system, so we bale graze all the cows and calves outside. Most of the growing and finishing stock are also outwintered for most of, if not all of the winter. So in a bale grazing situation, which is going to cost us more than just grazing stockpile, our cost of production throughout the winter has dropped from about £2.43 per head per day to £1.06 for every cow and calf pair. And I think it's 91p for a growing or finishing animal. So, that's basically whatever, three times cheaper per day, times that by however many hundred you've got on the farm over 180-day winter. That's a massive cost saving, which we've been able to direct that cost that we would have spent on straw or feed or whatever, into things like water infrastructure. And it pays itself back within a couple of months, not literally months, not even years. So it's had massive impacts on that. And again, when we talk about wintering, we haven't got cows and calves belly deep in mud. Yeah, I had someone comment on one of my Instagram videos this week saying, oh, your ground looks really dry. We've had so much rain. I was like, we've had the same rain. But again, it's the system. And when they're coming out of the cells, there's still leaf matter and cover above the soil. It's not muddy brown. It's like a tusky green of the pasture. So that's all in the planning. And that as a tool is bringing in other financial benefits and making our farm perform better. Yep. Things like the finishing time. So again, the genetics in the herd have very much stayed fairly similar. Probably in the last year or two, we've got a little bit more of the native Angus genetics coming through. But as I said, we were finishing all the cattle indoors on barley, all the calves and the ewes were creep fed concentrates before we transitioned. The average finishing time in the cattle back then was 28 months, whereas in the four-year AMP grazing system we've been doing, again, outwintering, cutting all the cost out, there's been no finishing on barley, no concentrate feeds. We're certified pasture for life, and our finishing times are range between 22 and 24 months. So we've shaved that down by 4 to 6 months. As well as the daily cost of production being way less. So it's had a massive impact that way. And, initially on this farm, we jumped straight into the deep end overnight. So the transition to regen literally happened overnight across the whole 400 hectares. And initially there was a bit of a destocking because we had to get our pasture and our soils ahead of the demand from the livestock. But now that we're kind of a couple of years down that track, our farm is so much more resilient, even in the droughts and the wet temperatures. And we grow so much more pasture than we ever used to. And it's much denser. There's much more biodiversity. So certain species do better at the start of the season, some at the end, some in dry or hot. So our ability to carry animals has bounced back. And our stocking rate is similar to what it was before we destocked, and we could definitely push that further from what it is now. The main reason we haven't basically is we've had quite an issue with TB breakdown. So we've not been able to really get out that cycle to either buy in livestock, and we've been losing more females than is obviously ideal. So our ability to grow the herd internally has been a bit stunted. So we can definitely see where the production capacity could be at right now, but essentially we've just ended up making more forage and having to sell that as opposed to it going to cattle in the winter, etc.
Amazing. Thanks, Silas. Emily, how about you?
We sell mostly as stores. So we sell between 16 and 19 months of age, so the second autumn. I would like to finish. And I think that's something we will move towards. We sell everything live. So we sell at our local market, which is Rugby Farmers Market. We aim to finish our lambs all off grass. We're not organic, but there's no real reason why we're not organic. It's just we haven't gone down that route. But we aim to finish our lambs at 45 kilos, 40 to 40, sort of mid to late 40s. We also retain our ewe lambs. So that's, and we do aim to top our ewe lambs, we're wanting to hit those weights of 40 to 45 kilos right across the board, because we're aiming to top at sort of mid-October, just into November for our ewe lambs. So has that changed? No, not dramatically, but our stocking rate has dropped back, partially because of the just restructuring of our farm to allow my stepson's some land. So we've lost some land. So the sheep flock has shrunk a bit, but equally we've upped our cattle numbers. So we've got in total 100 head of cattle. So, but in terms of the daily live weight gain, we're still sort of 275 to 300 grams for the sheep. And the sort of store cattle, we over some of them on herbal lays, which has actually worked incredibly well. We're just not sure whether we'll eke that last bit out. We don't really want to go into a second winter with our calves unless we take on more land. I think that's still going to be our format for selling animals.
This stocking density thing, it's not the be all and end all, is it? Like, if you've lowered your cost of production and the figures are still stacking up, people really get fixated on stocking density, and it's not about that, is it?
And I think that's a sort of disease of the industry, because you kind of judge your productivity and your performance on having the biggest, heaviest animals.
Yeah, and the most of them,
and you kind of prove your kudos as a farmer by having 1,000 sheep and doing it all yourself. Yeah. And actually but that often there's more money in doing less better.
Ian, how about you? Talk us through your production in terms of animal performance.
It's quite a difficult one at this stage because we moved from a 300 head or 262 to 300 head sheep flock. Mm-hmm. Into cattle in at the end of 2021. So we're really only getting our first cohort of home-born steers coming through there.
Yep.
Coming through their second winter, and they're coming up to sort of 20 months old, 22 months old now, and they've been out all winter. We don't weigh now. So mm-hmm. I went from having a system with the sheep where I was performance recorded. I weighed everything. I was religious with it. I had a pedigree performance recorded clinical lock, and was very involved in that side of things, and selling breeding stock and building a flock that way. With the cattle, we're pedigree Aberdeen Angus. We are selling. We've sold some. Entire bull calves at sort of mm-hmm. 10 months old at weaning. We are also looking to sell, well, ideally we'll be finishing and selling direct our product on the scale that we're at, because I want to eat the product myself, and I want other people to eat the product and know what it is they're eating. I don't really want it to go into the food chain the same way it does. I always felt very disappointed selling a very, what I consider a very high quality grass finished lamb into standard market. It feels wasted, because I know I've tasted both sides of the stuff that we produce and what I've bought elsewhere, and I know it doesn't compare, and therefore I don't want to sell it that way. I want to be able to engage with customers and have that relationship. So it's difficult to know at what point what our productivity is like at the moment. As you alluded to, it's not about yield. I'm more interested in having a live calf born every year. That's the most important thing to our bottom line. And we've so far in the last couple of years, we've had 100% pregnancy rates. So if we can keep that going, that's a great thing. And that's with heifers, putting heifers into the bull at 15 months and still getting 100% from our herd there. If we can get that performance, because a live calf born is worth substantially more than a slight increase in growth rates due to a faster finishing system or a faster finishing animal. I'd rather have that calf on the ground. If we have to sell stores, we'll sell stores. We'll get to it. It's quite possible that we will do that. I just don't think we'll have a farm big enough to keep producing as we are. We're building up. So I haven't really hit the maximum yet. I don't know where that maximum is because things changed a little bit this year. We gained a bit of ground over winter, which has changed dynamic again. So I don't really know where the max packs is for us yet with the cattle enterprise until we push on the buffer and find that it's run out of grass somewhere. It's at which point then you maybe sell some stores and scale back. But as long as we've always got that in our armory and a mm-hmm. choice that we can take, then that's great. I think we're set up in a nice way to go forward. I hope that does work out, and I hope that converts into cattle growth rates. They look healthy. They're out at the moment. The steers. I'll get some compensatory growth once they get onto fresh onto herbal lays or fresh grass this summer. They're a little. I suspect. I don't know. I suspect they've probably not suffered a bit, but they haven't exploded with their growth and maintained really high growth rates, but they'll have put on frame size. I'd be happy to show anybody them. Yeah, you know, come and see them. They're fit and healthy, and they've been on conserved forage and pretty poor quality wildflower meadow hay that was made in August.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I'm going to wrap this up with my key takeaways because I'm conscious that I've kept you way longer than I said I was going to do. So my first one that I've heard all of you say is farming in this way massively reduces your input costs, which can only be a plus. That also doesn't have to come at the cost of production. Might come at the cost of stocking rate, but that doesn't mean it's an unprofitable system. It's about figuring out your own costs. I love the bit that Emily said about do what you want. Like farming with ecology is not in mind is not a blueprint. There's varying different levels on the gradient of that, and it's about what your system can take and what you as an individual and a family business or whoever you're farming with wants to do. Thanks so much for giving me your time. It's really interesting to hear three very different systems, but all with very similar principles, but different markets again. So it just goes to show that this sort of way of farming can fit anywhere if you want it to. So I would really encourage everybody to take a look at the videos that we did with these guys, because they're really nicely done and it gives you a really good sort of overview of what they're doing at home. You can see actually what they're doing. I just want to remind everybody as well that there is a podcast with Jason Rowntree and some videos that my colleague Katie Evans produced whilst he was over here, and they're on the Roots to Resilience website. So we'll also put that link in the show notes, but if you search for AHDB Roots to Resilience, it'll take you straight to it as well. But that's all for me. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for organising it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, guys. We'll chat to you soon. Thank you.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.